the dialogue series Dancing in the Liminal, a global border-crossing inquiry into art, activism, spirituality, and leadership. I'm your dialogue hostess, Vanessa Fisher, and I'm here with my guest, Holly Mandel. Holly has been performing and teaching improvisation for over 15 years. In 2002, she founded her own school in New York City called Improvolution. She's also an alumni of the renowned improv and sketch theater company, The Groundlings, in Los Angeles. She's worked for Comedy Central and has taught at HBO Studios, the Barrow Group School, and Pace University, where she's helped to design the Comedy Studies program. For Holly, improvisation is much more than just a way to perform comedy. It helps students see, in a very safe and positive environment, where they're holding themselves back, and therefore can access deeper ways to develop authentic creativity, a deep sense of ease and trust, and powerful confidence in themselves. And I've personally known of Holly's work for about a year and was really interested to bring her on this show and find out more about what she's doing, and specifically her views on women's role in comedy and how improvisation as an art and practice can unlock new potentials for women's leadership. So, Holly, it's a real pleasure to have you, and welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Very excited to be here.
Yeah. So I want to talk specifically in this interview about the project you're doing called Good Girls Aren't Funny, and we will jump into that more deeply. But before we do that, I wanted to just start giving you a chance to share a little bit about your background and what got you into acting and what drew you to improv as an art form. Do you want to start there?
Sure, Vanessa. Great. Yeah. I started taking improv class because I had seen a bunch of adults doing improv when I was in middle school. In the Midwest where I'm from, there was no improv at the time. And so I was out in Los Angeles visiting, and I saw these adults do this crazy thing, and it was the most exciting thing I'd ever seen. I just couldn't believe people did it for a living. And they're, you know, looking back, I think what I picked up on was a type of freedom that they were expressing, and kind of a joy that I just didn't see a lot of other places. And it just, I don't know, for whatever reason, it sort of struck me. I'd always been interested in acting, but I think there was this, you know, the alive quality of improv just kind of met my needs. So when I graduated college, I was living out in Los Angeles. I'd gone to UCLA. I thought I was going to get into theater, and I actually started taking sociology and psychology classes. And that really rocked my world, because I realized there was a reason why people were the way they were, and it was a complicated picture, and that there were possibly ways that people could evolve and change that I hadn't really thought about before. So I ended up being a sociology and psychology double major, and I think that's actually what made me really appreciate the power of improv. I think I had a lens on it that I could see, like, wow, you know, people are able to develop. They're not as fixed as I know I used to think. You were who you were, and that was the end of it. So I started studying at the Groundlings, thinking that every class was going to be my last level there, and I kept moving up, and I kept going to the next level, and started realizing that maybe this was something I actually could do. So I made the decision to really go for it, and I became a Groundling in 1996, and it was just such a joy and a privilege to work with some of the people that were there. Some of my teachers are names that people know well, and people I was sharing the stage with. And, you know, it was a really exciting, happy time, because it's kind of like when you meet the thing that you're meant to do. There's such a joy and a delight in just being able to do it. And I started teaching, and I didn't think I'd enjoy being a teacher, and I didn't think I'd be good at it. And I was wrong on both counts, luckily. I really loved it. And one of the things that I saw was how people would come into class, and it was almost like there were two dimensions to them. There was the person who was nervous and scared and wanted to do it right and wanted to please me and, you know, figure out how to do it with the least risk. But there was also this other dimension that felt like it wanted to pop out. It felt like it was the thing that was laying under the surface. And I could very much relate to that. I think that's what started to happen to me, is like this person that I never let anyone really see was starting to pop out more and more as I did improv. And it was almost like a flexibility or fluidity of self was starting to happen.
And did you find that bled over into other aspects of your life, or was it just kind of in the improv theater?
100% other aspects. I mean, I was just becoming, it's funny, it was like I was becoming the person I always knew I was. And it was kind of beyond therapy. It wasn't like I needed to address issues, and it wasn't like I needed to overcome something. It was almost like I needed the space and the ability to play and let something emerge that was in there. That was more spontaneous, more confident, didn't need to really know, didn't need to figure anything out. And I think that's what theater really gives people, is permission to sort of test the boundaries of what you think yourself to be.
Yeah. Seems humor is an important part of that too, like being able to laugh at yourself in all of that as well.
Yeah, humor is a funny thing. I feel like it's twofold. I feel like humor emerges when there's just this kind of lightness and joy. Mm-hmm. And I find that that's really what is an indicator that you're onto something true and real. People can read the same lines in a script. They can do the exact same gestures as somebody else. But if it's not coming from this kind of freed up, a place that's free of self-consciousness, it can land very differently. And so I think humor also kind of shows, oh, yeah, there's something real happening here.
Yeah, absolutely. I just had this one quote I wanted to read that you'd said about improv and what it taught you. You said, improv taught me that I could have a very different relationship to life, one that's more fearless, more trusting, more at ease, and full of possibility, where working with others is more rewarding than going it alone and being the one, and where not already knowing isn't scary as it is exciting. Did you want to speak a little bit to the not going it alone as the one? I mean, I imagine improv is quite relational, I guess you can do individual improv too, but it's quite a relational process in theater, I imagine.
It really is. I mean, when I teach it, I really have to make sure people understand it's a team sport, and it's not like stand-up. And I think stand-up, you know, not that it's a bad thing, it's definitely not my strength, but I find stand-up is one person kind of commenting on what they're seeing in the world, and it's coming very much from that person's perspective. You like Louis C.K. because you want to know what Louis C.K. thinks about everything. Right. But with improv, you're creating moments together, and you want it to be as alive and spontaneous as it can be, and you really need to work as a team to do that. And one of the things, I mean, it wasn't necessarily what I said in the quote, but I'm just realizing more and more, it also happens in accordance with the audience. Like, you're not separate from the audience in that moment of discovery and creation. And that's what's so thrilling about it, is they're right along there with you, and they realize that you don't know any more than they do. Mm-hmm. And so you're together with them in a way that creates a unity that you don't find a lot in theater. You know, usually the performers know exactly where the show's going, and the audience is along for the ride. And this is definitely different.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, let's weave this all into talking about your project with Good Girls Aren't Funny. And this was a project that was really born out of your curiosity about women's role in comedy. And you created a talk in 2009 that led to the creation of women-focused improvisation workshops. Is that right?
Yeah, yes.
And so you were specifically looking at this archetype of the good girl and how you saw it holding back women, not only in acting, but in life and leadership. And so I was just curious if you could tell us a bit about what you mean by the good girl, if you want to share a little bit about how you got the idea for the project also, and just kind of where this comes from for you.
Sure. Yeah. No, I could talk about this for hours. and I do. Yeah. You know, I was never really interested in women's studies. I grew up in the Midwest, where the word feminist was kind of a bad word. And my aunt was one, and she was all, I just thought, oh, she's always angry about something. And I just didn't really think that feminism was a valid study anymore. We kind of got everything we wanted, and we just got to move on from there. And that idea that I didn't really need to think about women's issues separate from just being a human being was happening at the same time that I was aware of some discrepancies that didn't make sense to me. So as an improv student, I realized there were times where I felt very confident and strong, but then I'd show up in a show really insecure and make different choices that just didn't make any sense to me. And I just always thought, oh, that must mean you stink as an improviser. You're not good enough yet. Then I started teaching, and I would notice women would be very comfortable and strong. They'd come in about halfway through a class, and they would just kick butt all the way to the end. And then when we did our shows, they would shrink. They also took a long time to warm up. But once they kind of warmed up, they'd really let themselves shine. But they wouldn't, like, show how good they were right off the bat. Then I was working at Comedy Central, and you know, just to make a long story short, my job was to really promote the newest stand-ups and comedians, and I was always trying very hard to highlight women. That was just something that was like a no-brainer for me, mm-hmm. and I had a hard time finding, you know, the edgiest, funniest, most clever, different material was not coming from the women, mm-hmm. and there weren't a lot of women to pick from anyway, but their stuff was just either about sex, self-degrading. It was just kind of like the same thing with a different face every time. And I just was noticing this weird trend. I started my own improv school in 2002, and I thought, okay, I'm a woman. I'm running my own school. I'm really going to make sure that I create strong women here. And I just found like, wow, something still is going on. And so a very good friend, I think somebody that you know as well, Dr. Elizabeth DeBold, gave me a book that connected a lot of dots for me, and it had to do with this good girl structure, and it placed it in a very particular time in women's history. And I never thought, I think as a postmodern woman, I think a lot of us, at least myself, thought we were sort of free of everything that came before. It's like, oh, well, my poor grandma, my mom had it tough, but now I'm free. And I don't think I really understood the way consciousness develops and that these structures, thank God, are still in us. And different things activate them and different things trigger them. And in the spectrum of kind of human development, you know, we've been kind of liberated from the past. It's been a blink of an eye. I mean, it's such a new moment for women that a lot of the old is definitely still in there. And when it gets triggered, it speaks very loudly still. Yeah.
So where do you think the good girl comes from? Like, what's the origin, or how do you see that, where she's originating from?
Yeah, it's really fascinating. I mean, I don't claim to be an expert at all in it, and I say that in my talk and in my class. I think I'm highlighting one moment that, to me, is enough of a moment to at least say, hey, there's some stuff going on here that, as women, we want to get interested in. And it's not to demonize men at all. I mean, this was kind of a co-created situation, and we've survived up till now, which is pretty awesome. So something's working. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, you know, in my talk, I talk about how the first women's history class in the world happened in 1963. So just us getting interested in our own history is still relatively new. So there's probably going to be more and more pieces. But this one book by Dalma Hine, which is called The Marriage Shock, she was trying to figure out particular pattern she was noticing across all ages or all classes, that when women would get in a serious relationship or get married, some kind of external voice seemed to click in that told them how they should be as a good wife. And she started researching and found conduct books from the 1700s, 1800s. Men had their own conduct books, and it was this moment in history, and again, I'm just kind of paraphrasing what I've learned, mm-hmm. where it was the modern era, at least in Europe and in America, and, you know, it was the Industrial Revolution. So the first time there was a middle class, and it was the first time there was social mobility, and those two things created a very interesting predicament in culture. Men could leave the little villages and the little pig farms and go move into the big cities and become wealthy, and it was the first time the word nobleman changed from something that was a birthright to something that you could become a nobleman. I mean, it was like such a radical moment. But women had no means of rising up socially. So the really beautiful ones and the ones that came from money, those ladies got picked up pretty quickly. But men were in droves moving up socially, and they needed a woman. What worked seemed to be this idea of the good woman, a virtuous, selfless, kind, kind of vapid, very happy to please, you know, basically this idea of you were measured and valued on your purity and your goodness, and it was something you had to learn, and you had to learn it fast.
Yeah, and I would just add to that, you know, with the instability happening, like you were just saying, all of the instability happening with the changes in the modern era and the shifts in the economic structures, that women really became the representation of stability. So it's like they were holding the home and the hearth. And it's like as men's roles are completely changing, the women were supposed to be holding the stability of the home. And so that really became like the kind of archetype for women at that time, too.
Yeah, no, that makes complete sense. And one thing I remember reading somewhere was, you know, if you were a woman at that time, you probably would, before the Industrial Revolution, you'd probably live down the street from your family. You know, you'd probably live in the same village. Now you were going into the cities. I mean, there weren't really even cities before. And so you were kind of isolated in your home, and so you had to really kind of take that on as your project.
Yeah, like the nuclear family, you know, emerges.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And I was going to add, too, that women were kind of seen as being non-sexual, and men were these, like, really crazy sexual beings. And in a way, our sexual purity became our kind of allure. Mm-hmm. So there's this just an interesting dynamic of how characteristics got, you know, bifurcated. You know, they were turned into binaries, and certain genders had certain qualities, and other genders had other qualities. Was more flexible before that in certain ways, yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I got the sense that women's sexuality also was something that had to be kind of monitored and managed because, you know, she was far away from home and she was alone during the day. There was a lot more opportunity, I think, for her to kind of run wild. And so there was something about really managing her chastity and her sexuality. And I think there's different books, Jane Austen and other people have written, and you just see there's just a real clampdown.
Definitely. Because she's responsible for that stability. That really, I mean, she's representing the stability of the home, but it's really also the stability of the society. You know, so that projection is, you know, quite intense.
Yeah.
So you see this still impacting women in comedy, in, you know, the women you're working with. Can you talk a little bit about how, I mean, you talked a little bit about how it shows up. Why do you think this is still impacting us now? Why do you think all the changes we've gone through in the last 100 years, why is that still hanging around, do you think?
Well, it's fascinating. I mean, to me, it was just like a light bulb moment, and it very much explained a lot of things about myself, that when I got nervous and insecure, which doesn't happen all the time every day, but especially in improv, it comes up all the time. And I think in performing, and I think when you're trying to push an edge and you're not sure how the audience is going to react, you know, it's very different than if you're doing the exact same thing every day and everything around you is sort of secure and stable. I don't know how strongly this voice would kick in, but I think this voice is meant to guide us when we don't know if we should go left or right. And I just remember the first time I really heard her, it was actually after I watched Gone with the Wind, and Melanie, the character, stuck in my brain from that moment forward as this guiding force. If you don't know the movie, she is like this image of, you know, perfection for a woman. She has no faults. She's completely milquetoast and boring, but she does everything right, and she just forgives, and she's just so good. Mm-hmm. And I remember a friend at school was really, you know, one of my best friends, who, of course, the next day means she's mean to you. as young girls, we are, you know, it's crazy. But she was just really horrible to me, and I went home crying, and I just was like, you know, part of me was like, hey, I wanted to stick up for myself, but this voice kicked in, and it sounded like Melanie, and it just said, you know, you just need to make the peace. You need to just forgive. Mm-hmm. So the next day, I went and gave her Love's Baby Soft perfume, and I apologized to her to keep the peace, and it felt so good and it felt so right that being nice and being liked was survival. Mm-hmm. It was the most important thing, and that to me was, I went back and I looked and I thought, okay, this stuff is still very active, and for comedy and improv specifically, it comes up when you don't know what to do next. And that's what I've really seen. It was actually an accident. I was going to teach a day class, an improv day class. And it was supposed to be mixed men and women. And for some weird reason, none of the men could come. And so I walked into a class and it was all women. And I thought, you better seize the moment here. And so I just started experimenting with this voice that's very external. And it's very different than your authentic voice. It's just, a lot of times our authentic voice, this is just me personally, I find, is a lot quieter sometimes, and it's a lot less confident, and this should is really loud, and it's meant to protect you from doing the wrong thing, being seen as imperfect. God forbid another woman sees you make a mistake. I mean, that kind of intensity of, you know, somebody cut your neck, it feels like you're bleeding from your jugular when you allow yourself to be seen as less than perfect around a bunch of women. And so we just started going in there and exposing this fear and this obsession with being the one and being perfect as being universal, as being something that all women have. And it was such a relief, I think, for women just to know this wasn't just them. And the competition that would come up between them, the insecurity that would come up, that we could just put it on the table. And it was amazing how quickly a trust developed that was deeper and that would allow them to kind of hold formation in themselves and together when this thing would kick in.
Would you like kind of play with it a little bit, like, you know, act it out or like just kind of role play it? Would that help sometimes?
It's funny. It did to a point, and then it would almost make it stronger. So we actually found a lot of benefit going the other direction, where we'd play genderless characters, or sometimes we'd actually play guys that we knew, and it allowed us to kind of see the fluidity of who we were, and that there was almost this preoccupation with being nice and good, that when we gave ourselves permission not to be there, we'd be a lot more straight. Right. We'd listen to our gut a lot more, and we wouldn't apologize for it. And we'd also be able to kind of hold our ground. So if somebody, I mean, for those who've done improv before, I'm sure it makes a lot of sense. If you haven't, if you can just imagine, you're up on stage, you're pretending to be, you know, stuck on a submarine, and you're being fired at, and you really don't know what your next line is going to be. You kind of have to, for the sake of the scene and your partners, you have to really be behind your ideas, because you're making it up and your partners need you to come up with ideas. You don't want to just leave it to somebody else to do it. You have to be responsible. And I think that's where the leadership and responsibility piece, I see very interesting connection, because, you know, it forces you to be responsible even if you don't feel ready. And you do override this kind of worry about getting it right. It's like, well, you have to kind of work through that a little bit and test the ground and be willing to be wrong. And that's had a lot of benefit, too.
I find also the more, I mean, just for me personally, the more mistakes I make, the stronger I kind of get. You know? So it's like the more times you go through failure and realize you're not going to die. You know? Right. Or the more people you know that don't like you and you realize you don't die. I mean, at least momentarily, like you make a mistake, someone doesn't like what you said or whatever. I mean, you realize that, you know, that you're not going to die because someone doesn't like you, or, you know, because you made a mistake or you failed at something.
It's totally
true. And it's a lot more about your ability to recover from that, I find, or your, like how you come out of it, more than, you know, whether you make a mistake.
Totally agreed. And one thing just to add real quick, I do my talk for now both men and women, and then the class is obviously just for women, but men, a lot of men teachers and other performers have started coming to the talk, and they've gotten a lot out of it because it's cool. I mean, they're like, I see these women in my class and they're amazing, and then sometimes they disappear and I don't know why. And I don't want to draw conclusions that they're not a good improviser, but I don't know what to do. And this kind of helps them understand what might trigger it. And I've had guys come up to me and say, well, you know, we're kind of preoccupied with the same worry. Why do you think it's just women? And I was like, oh, that's a really good question. And it's connected to what you just said. I think there's an irrational fear because it has to do with survival and security. And there's this scene in Pride and Prejudice that I love because I'm like, yeah, right on. It's Lizzie's friend. I can't think of her name right now, but she's kind of the frumpy one and not as confident as Lizzie. And this really kind of frumpy preacher ends up wanting to marry her. And Lizzie's like, why are you marrying this guy? And the woman's like, hello, I'm getting older and I'm a burden to my parents. And if I don't get married now, my options are like what? I'm going to become either like a school marm or a prostitute. I don't even know what the options were. But none of them were that pretty. And she's like, you don't seem to understand. It's like, I have to get married for survival. And I think the concern about getting it right and being perfect and not making a mistake is so linked to such a deep fear that feels really right, of like, hey, I'm not going to take the risk here. I'm going to support. I'm going to back up. I'm going to help. But I'm not going to be the one on the edge that takes all the hits. And I think that's what's going to make women comedians really stand out, is taking that next step. Because I know in myself, I will support till I'm blue in the face, and that just always feels right. And yet after I sit back down after doing a show, I feel terrible, because I knew I wanted to be on the edge, but I let some other voice kind of guide me, and now I know the difference.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So would you say that when we're in that moment where we don't know what's next, so you're saying on that edge, that the automatic kind of default is to go back to old roles, or to kind of go back to something that feels more secure, rather than kind of push forward into our own edge?
I think that's what we're kind of unfortunately still programmed a little bit. And of course, not every woman's the same, but in general, I think we have programming that was meant to keep us, you know, was survival based, and thank God, because we made it this far. But I think it kicks up now in times and places where we may just want to put space around it and try to see if we can feel the difference between our more authentic voice that might even be more genderless or less concerned about the affirmation that we get as women. And, you know, Sheryl Sandberg's book, I think, points to something not dissimilar. There's just different voices and forces and motives in men and women. And I just think we want to start getting clear on what's going on in there.
And I think also, like, I think the subtitle of your talk is, you know, also how we hold each other back as women.
Yeah.
And I think that that's another issue is, like, you know, it's one thing to overcome yourself, you know? But then when you're working with, you know, other women not perceiving you as being what you should be, or, you know, all those things are also difficult.
Yeah.
So it's a tender edge, you know, we want to challenge, but we also want to support. And it's that tender edge that I think as women we're still learning for each other too, as well as ourselves.
I think it's really important. I think it's like almost, I've seen it as almost the key, because you can be a very strong, confident woman. I'm guessing you are one. I've become one. I know a lot. But the minute you get into a group of women, either you find yourself having to be competing against another woman, or you evoke a very insecure place in a woman who sees you as a threat because you're confident. And so I feel, and what I think happened in the 60s, as far as my understanding is it was a real unifying moment for women. And I think we really have to see, it's not better or worse, but it's just a little bit different than the way men have had to kind of develop. We need to do this together. And so I feel when we start to see, oh, the insecurity and the competition that's being evoked in my sister is the same in myself. It's, we're not different. And I can be more sensitive, I think, to that. Women don't freak me out the way they used to. I used to be very mistrusting of women. I was just like, I just want to hang out with guys. They're just simpler to get. I don't. And now I just feel like that movie, The Sixth Sense. It's like, I see women. I don't even see men anymore. I just see women, and I feel such an affinity to them. And I think it's because I've seen through this illusion that we're separate and sort of not trustworthy.
Yeah. Have you found that the improv as a practice has helped build relationships between the women you work with, like in and outside of the acting?
For sure, 100%. I mean, I think when we take a stand on the other side of this, we become very trustworthy ourselves. And I think women can sense that. And I'm just aware in working environments, I don't even have to consciously do it as much. Sometimes I do. But, I feel like I have to be a representation of what I know. And it just creates a lot of ease when you don't pick up the, tool. When somebody tries to engage in some of the old dynamics of competition or all that stuff. It's like when you don't pick that up, I think it's a lot more powerful than we realize. It's almost like when everyone puts their weapons down, or if you're in the presence of women who've put their weapons down, it's something that men can't do for women. We have to do it for each other. And I have found it affects every dimension of my life, for sure.
And do you find improv is sort of unique for that, in the sense that because you're stepping into this unknown place together, like I'm just imagining there's kind of a way that you have to really trust each other to be able to do that, you know, and then to, you know, and then you have to be able to laugh together, and you have to be able to like hold each other's mistakes and all those things,
you know? Improv creates a really nice, I would love it if every woman who this kind of interests would take an improv class and, you know, test these things out. Of course you have to be with a teacher that is sensitive to all these things, but improv is such a cool tool because it's playtime and you get to experiment and you get to do it sort of off the clock, but the muscles that you're working are real, and so you get the takeaway is real, but the stakes are different because it's just, you know, a class, but you really can test out different dimensions of yourself, and you can really start to, like you said, trust a part of yourself that you maybe don't always get to get behind. And then when you do it with other women, you do build something for real. It doesn't go away when the class is over. It's right. It's a real relationship.
So are you hoping to keep doing the presentations and building on these courses? What's your kind of hope for the classes in the future?
I'm bi-coastal right now, which I'm loving, between New York, where my school is, and I also teach at Pace University, and so I have a lot of women in my classes there that I'm trying to, I do a talk at the university. They're nice enough to let me do it there. And then when I go out to LA, I teach it there. And there's a couple women teachers also through the Groundlings that are starting to get interested in it, because, you know, the Groundlings has created some of the biggest names in women's comedy right now. You know, Kristen Wiig, Melissa McCarthy, Cheryl Hines. There's just a lot of women that are very front and center in comedy. And I know the Groundlings wants to be a place that you go to, and same with my school, and you are feel supported by other women there. And so I teach a class when I go back there, and I'm hoping to create more classes and opportunity for women to really test this out together, because I think it won't take, I don't think it would take very long for there to be a kind of a shift where you go from individual women making strides to actually groups of women. I feel like there's like a tipping point there somewhere. I would love for women to come take the class no matter what they're doing, even if they're accountants.
Yeah, I was curious, like, do you have people that come in that are just, like, are they aspiring actresses, or do you get people from all walks of life?
Well, the really nice thing is, in the beginning, it actually even wasn't that conscious, I have to admit, but I just wanted improv. I wanted everyone to take improv. I just think for people to look at it only as performing and comedy is kind of a disservice to what improv can be. And mm-hmm. So our motto is improv for everyone. And I would say only a third of our students are professionals in the acting world. Everybody else just is weirdly attracted to this bizarre craft where you have no idea what you're doing and you make mistakes left and right and you have a blast and you can't get enough of it. And so that's kind of where we're fitting in the world of improv right now.
Kind of makes a lot of sense to me. Like, you know, any skill that I've tried to master, especially presenting, like public speaking. Like, I remember when I first started public speaking, my first presentation at a university where I had to, like, present on a topic that I was really passionate about, I completely froze in the front, like, completely. Like, you know, embarrassing kind of freezing in front of everyone that came to see me, you know? And I was a pretty articulate person, like, when I was, you know, talking to people. So I was devastated because for me, I felt like that was it. You know, if I had gone on stage and I couldn't, you know, and I froze, that means I'm never going to be a public speaker. And, you know, it was like really devastating for me. And so I found, like, I mean, it's just interesting because as I've developed public speaking, I feel like that's been my biggest practice. And a lot of it is like practicing improvisation. Like, of course, you want to, like, prepare for your speech. You don't want to go in with nothing. But it's like I've always felt that it's this huge balance between your ideas and then, like, when you're on stage, you have to be so present. Like, you can't be reading, even if your ideas are profound, if you're reading off of, you know, a projector or, you know, a sheet of paper, just like you were saying, when it's different between a scripted play and then an improvised play, you know, because you're really with the audience. I mean, both can be good. A speech that's written can be also be very good. But I find there's a different quality for me, at least, when I have the ideas, but then I really work with the audience and I'm attuned to, like, the energy of the audience. So in a lot of ways, I see, like, a lot of crossover, you know, whether you're acting or whatever field you're in. I imagine it would be extremely, you know, transferable as a skill.
It really is. And I think I've often found, like, there's an internalizing of a kind of a confidence of what you're speaking about, where the person goes, I'm not my speech. I'm not the scene I'm doing. I'm not the game that I'm playing in this improv class. I'm actually very big, very competent. I have a lot of experience and I trust myself. And so there's this one thing that I want to say, and you don't ride everything on it. You just know that this is just part of who you are. Versus, I see so much when people come into class, like, if they do one exercise wrong, they do one game wrong, they're totally deflated.
Yeah.
They've lowered their self to being equivalent to just one game.
Yeah.
And one scene. And their self-worth is so connected to this external thing. And I think as women, from what I understand about our ability to relate to other and be relational, I think we're in some ways probably good, in some ways probably harmful, able to kind of shrink and expand who we are too much. Yeah. And so there's this kind of, like, I'm not just the one exercise or the one talk that I have found has helped me a lot in being able to kind of keep moving, like you said, and let the bumps and the mistakes not take me down. And I think it really has to do with a sensitivity that we have, that we might want to just start exercising a different muscle, really.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, what you described is pretty much exactly like what happened to me when I did this one presentation. And I was like 20 years old and I thought that was it.
Yeah, yeah.
it's like it's over.
Right.
it's and done for me.
All your experience,
and all your intelligence. It matters nothing at all.
Nothing in that moment, yeah. And, yeah, I was curious, like, is that particularly something you see more in women than men?
I would have to say, really honestly, yeah. I mean, I know there's going to be men who say, hey, that you're describing me to a T. I think it's this deep throwing the baby out with the bathwater that I see women do that surprises me. I think the pendulum swing where somebody's really confident and strong in one class and then they come and they start off the class a little shaky and for the rest of the class they've just decided they suck. And I don't see men going through quite the same process of attaching their worth and their abilities to any one particular moment.
Do you think women also have a harder time, like, looking silly and, like, kind of being... Like, I'm just thinking as, like, even just on the level of, like, our appearance and how much attention we seem to, like, some women can pay to that or, like, how
yeah.
we feel we should. So is there, like, a fear of, like, I don't want to look stupid more or I don't want to look silly or dumb or more, do you think, than men in that way, even just at, like, a basic physical level?
100%. Yes, 100%. I feel that there's a really direct connection between... looking ugly and looking silly and being a female performer and, you know...
Well, there's so much scrutiny. I mean, even, you know, in like being an actress in Hollywood, I mean, there's so much scrutiny on women and their appearance, I mean, or in politics or anything.
Completely. Oh, completely. All the time. And I think we're aware our value is very much on how attractive we are. And I know for a fact that one of the things that I never was too worried about looking really ugly and disgusting. I remember there's one scene where I walked out basically in my bra and underwear, but I made sure I looked just horrible. And I just wore support hose and really tried to push my stomach up and over and just looked disgusting. You know, it was like I wanted to be this gross woman. And there's such freedom in it. I had so many women, I remember saying, like, how do you do that? And they just, I think we are caught in these two worlds where we have to decide, you know, where do we want to put our weight? I heard one story about a comedic actress who I won't name because I don't know how accurate a story it is, but she's very attractive. She's always in magazines for being cute, and she was trying very hard to break out of the kind of role she was getting. Yeah, so she, you know, was very consciously trying to break out of a stereotype of just the cute girl. Mm-hmm. And so she was given a film that where she could play somebody that wasn't attractive, that was kind of a little bit off-center. And my friend was her hair and makeup stylist. And so, she, you know, she wanted her to have this kind of plain Jane look and almost a little goofy looking. And this actress would go then into her trailer and put on makeup and redo her hair. And mm-hmm. after a while, they just stopped fighting her. And you could see how deeply she was connected. Even though she wanted to be a comedic actress, she couldn't let go of being attractive first.
Interesting.
So I think you're really right about that.
I was thinking, too, I had a moment... When I was 19, when I really felt like I wanted to do public speaking, like I just kind of had an intuition that that was something mm-hmm. I wanted to do. And I remember looking in the mirror one day and I'm imagining, like, I just had this image of doing this big speech. And then I actually said to myself, but what if I looked ugly that day?
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it's at 19, right? And it was like a big thing. Like I had this total whole body contraction of like, I can't put myself out like that. I mean, you know, the one woman I'm really loving right now, and I'm gonna forget her name and feel like a total jerk, but she's producing the girls show. What's her name?
Oh, Leah Dunham.
Yeah, and I mean, the show is just hilarious to me, but I love it, you know. But she's just, I mean, what she's the stereotype she's breaking, and at the age she is, I just think it's profound. So I'm totally into her these days.
I agree. I totally agree. Yeah.
Yeah. Big stuff.
And she's, and it's amazing how much attention she's getting for, it's not even the content. I feel the most of the attention is like, how dare you let yourself be filmed so unflattering?
Like, how you dare you be naked and not be like a size two? You
know? Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah,
that's what they're focusing on, not the content.
Yeah, pretty amazing.
Yeah.
If people want to learn more about the Good Girls Aren't Funny project or just get involved with what you're doing at Improvolution, what would be some resources they could look into?
Sure. Right now, we have a Facebook page, Good Girls Aren't Funny Facebook. I'm finding that's just the easiest way to keep in touch. And if I go to any city to do my talk or do any workshops, it'll pop up there.
Okay.
And then there'll be a website, of course, to follow. But I'm finding Facebook very helpful right now. And yeah. My school, Improvolution, is in New York City. So if anybody listening is in New York, you can look us up, improvolution.org. And I go out to L.A. to the Groundlings every couple months, and I will be teaching out there. But if I do that, it'll happen through – I'll also post it through the Facebook page. So that's kind of where things are at. And I'm really excited about giving the talk, and I'm going down to an all-girls school next week for middle school girls.
Oh, and awesome. That's such a perfect timing to be doing that.
I think so, too. I'm really excited Absolutely. About how that's going to go. So that's kind of the next Awesome. Front.
I wish I'd had that at middle school.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Me, too. I know. Yeah. I know. It'd be Awesome. Fun. Yeah.
Well, great. Well, it's been great talking to you, and I hope we can stay in touch. I think it's cool what you're doing.
Oh, well, thank you. I think it's cool what you're doing. Well, this has been so great. Thank you. Yeah. I love talking about it. Thank you so much for thinking of me.